You've got Radio Hangar. Real aviation talk, real passion. Let's go. This is the Hangar, and I'm Taildragger. Glad you're here tonight. Pull up a chair, because we're going to talk about one of the most audacious, outrageous, and frankly misunderstood flying machines ever built. We're talking about the Hughes H-4 Hercules. You know it better by the name Howard Hughes. Absolutely hated, the Spruce Goose. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let me set the stage for you. It's 1942. The United States is in serious trouble in the Atlantic. German U-boats are sinking Allied cargo ships faster than the shipyards can build them. We're talking hundreds of ships going to the bottom, thousands of tons of critical war supplies, fuel, food, ammunition, just gone. The wolf packs are absolutely shredding the convoy routes. And the thing is, we need to get men and material to Europe, or we lose the war. It's that simple. So a man named Henry Kaiser, the industrialist, the guy who was already building Liberty ships faster than anyone thought possible, he comes up with an idea. What if we fly the cargo over instead? Build massive flying boats out of wood, because aluminum and steel are rationed for the war effort. Fly them right over the U-boat threat. And he knows exactly who to call to design the thing. Howard Hughes. Now here's where it gets interesting. Hughes was already famous by 1942. He'd set speed records, he'd flown around the world in 91 hours back in 1938. He'd built the H-1 Racer, that gorgeous little silver bullet of an airplane that was years ahead of its time. The man understood aerodynamics at a level that made engineers at established companies nervous. But he was also, let's be honest, difficult, obsessive, a perfectionist in a way that didn't always play well with deadlines and budgets. The government gave Hughes and Kaiser a contract. Build three of these giant flying boats. The designation was HK1, H for Hughes, K for Kaiser. The specs were staggering. A wingspan of 320 feet, for context that's longer than a football field, wider than a Boeing 747 by more than 100 feet. 8 Pratt and Whitney R4-360, WASP major engines, each one putting out 3,000 horsepower, 28 cylinders per engine. That's 224 cylinders total. Just think about that for a second. 224 cylinders. The whole airframe was to be built from birch wood, laminated and bonded with a special resin process called Duramold. Not spruce, by the way. Birch, that nickname, Spruce Goose, it was a newspaper invention, and Hughes despised it. He once said he'd never use that name, and anyone who worked for him better not either. Kaiser dropped out of the project pretty early. The politics, the delays, Hughes's insistence on doing everything his way, it was too much, so it became the H-4 Hercules, purely a Hughes project. And here's where the story gets complicated, because the war ended before the airplane was finished. Now imagine you're a senator in 1947. The war's over. Hughes has spent $22 million of government money, which in today's money is something north of $300 million, and he's got one airplane, not three, one. And it hasn't flown, there's a congressional investigation. Senator Ralph Owen Brewster from Maine hauls Hughes in front of a committee accusing him of war profiteering, of wasting taxpayer money on a boondoggle that would never fly. And Hughes, say what you will about the man, he didn't back down. He sat in that hearing room in Washington, and he told the committee, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the Hercules was his obsession, his money, his reputation, and if the airplane was a failure, he'd leave the country and never come back. Bold words. But Hughes was a bold man.
Now let me take you to Long Beach, California. November 2, 1947. The Hercules is in the water at Terminal Island. Hughes has been running taxi tests in the harbor, back and forth, testing the engines, testing the control surfaces, getting a feel for this enormous machine. He's got a crew on board. He's got reporters and industry people watching from the shore and from invited boats. He's got newsreel cameras rolling. The plan officially is just taxi tests, nothing more. Hughes climbs into the left seat. The cockpit of this thing is like a small room. The instrument panel is vast. The yoke is enormous. He's got his flight engineer, Dave Grant, beside him and the rest of the crew at their stations. He fires up those 8 WASP majors, one by one, and the sound, friends, witnesses, said you could feel it in your chest from a quarter mile away. A deep, rolling thunder that rattled windows along the waterfront. He taxis out into the harbor, makes a couple of runs. Everything looks nominal, the hull is tracking straight, the engines are running smooth. Then he lines up for one more run. He pushes the throttles forward, all 8 engines come up to full power. The Hercules accelerates across the water, throwing up massive rooster tails of spray on either side, and then, something happens that nobody on the shore quite believes. The nose lifts, the hull breaks free of the water, and the Hughes H-4 Hercules, the airplane they said was too big to fly,
The airplane a United States senator called a flying lumberyard rises into the air, 70 feet off the water, about a mile of distance. Roughly 1 minute of flight time, it flew. Now let me paint this picture a little more because I think it matters. Witnesses said the transition from water to air was surprisingly smooth. The airplane didn't lurch or stagger into the sky. It lifted almost gently, like Hughes had it on rails. He held it steady at 70 feet, made no attempt to climb, no turns, nothing dramatic, just straight and level over the harbor at about 80 miles an hour. Then he eased the power back, settled it onto the water, and taxied back in. That was it, one flight, 1 minute, 70 feet. And that was the only time the Hercules ever flew.
Here's the part of the story that doesn't get told enough, though. After that flight, Hughes didn't scrap the airplane. He didn't walk away from it. He kept it in a climate-controlled hangar in Long Beach, maintained by a full-time crew. For nearly 30 years, every system was kept operational. The engines were run regularly, the control surfaces were exercised. Hughes paid the equivalent of $1 million a year to keep the Hercules ready to fly, even though no one, including Hughes himself, ever intended to fly it again. Think about that. This man who was growing more reclusive, more troubled, more isolated from the world year after year, he kept that airplane alive. Some people say it was vanity, some say it was obsession. I think it was something simpler than that. I think Howard Hughes was a pilot and that airplane was his proof that the impossible wasn't. He died in 1976. The Hercules was eventually donated and moved to the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum in McMinnville, Oregon, where it sits today. And I've been there, friends. I've stood under that wing. I've looked up at those 8-engine nacelles hanging above me like the pillars of some kind of aviation cathedral. It takes your breath away. The wingspan is so wide that your brain doesn't quite process it at first. You keep looking left and right, and the wing just keeps going. The fuselage is tall enough to walk through upright, and wide enough that you could park a couple of pickup trucks side by side inside it. The cockpit, when you peer into it through the display glass, still has that utilitarian, no-nonsense layout that Hughes insisted on. This wasn't a showpiece. This was an airplane built to carry 750 troops or 150,000 pounds of cargo across an ocean. It just never got the chance. Now, was the Hercules a success or a failure? I've been arguing this one at fly-in breakfasts for decades. On one hand, it flew exactly once, never carried a single pound of cargo, and cost a fortune. On the other hand, the engineering that went into it pushed the boundaries of what people thought was possible in aircraft design. The Duramold construction techniques influenced composite manufacturing for years afterward, and the sheer audacity of the thing, building the largest airplane the world had ever seen in the middle of a world war, out of wood, that's aviation at its most ambitious. I come down on the side of calling it a triumph, not because of what it accomplished in practical terms, but because of what it represented. Howard Hughes looked at a problem, the U-boat threat, and his answer was to build the biggest flying machine in history. And then, when the politicians and the press said it would never fly, he climbed into the cockpit and proved them wrong. 1 minute at 70 feet. Sometimes that's enough. You know, there's a lesson in there for anyone who's ever tried to do something that other people said couldn't be done. Whether it's building a giant flying boat or learning to fly or restoring an old Stearman in your garage, the people who say it can't be done are never the ones who do it. Hughes did it. For tonight's show, I drew on historical accounts from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum archives, the Evergreen Aviation Museum's own research on the H-4 Hercules, and several excellent accounts from aviation historians. This broadcast is brought to you by Radio Hangar, an AI-generated program created by pilots who love this stuff as much as you do. You can find us and our source notes at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Thanks for spending some time in the hangar with me tonight. Go visit McMinnville if you ever get the chance. Stand under that wing, let it sink in. And next time somebody tells you something is impossible, just remember, a man built the biggest airplane in the world out of birch plywood and sheer stubbornness, and he flew it. Clear skies and tailwinds, friends. Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.